Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Well, let's see now. There's a deal on the debt limit. We'll tell you about that. And I don't know, you guys, if they're paying Janet Yellen enough in her big new job. 7 hours worth of questions for the new head of the Federal Reserve today. We'll tell you about that as well, but you're going to have to stick around. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Tuesday, everybody. It's the 11th of February, and go ahead and mark your calendars because we have a deal. The debt limit crisis is no more. The House has passed what's called a clean bill. They passed it this afternoon. Marketplace's David Gura has been following the story all day long. Hey, David.
Hey, Kai.
They had some time yet, the House did, to pass this thing. 2 weeks until the Treasury Secretary said we were going to actually run out of money to pay bills. Why now?
Yeah, so we officially hit the debt ceiling a couple of days ago, and since then the Treasury Department's been sort of shuffling money around using what it calls extraordinary measures, Kai, to keep us solvent. The House is supposed to go on recess tomorrow. Uh-huh. Lawmakers are supposed to be home all next week in their districts for President's Day. And on top of that, Kai, there is this meteorological motivator. We're supposed to get a big snowstorm here tonight. So
Cowards.
All that's playing out of the background. Those are the big motivators. And then this morning, the House Speaker, John Boehner, said he didn't have the votes to push through a debt ceiling increase with anything tacked onto it. So that's how we got to where we are.
What did they want to put on here that would have made it a not clean bill, I guess?
Well, it's a long list of stuff. Republican lawmakers met up a couple of weeks back on the eastern shore of Maryland for their retreat. And they started floating proposals, you know, what they could attach to a debt limit increase that would get enough support to pass. And there was the, you know, approval of the Keystone XL pipeline. There were changes to the Affordable Care Act, to Obamacare. And there was talk of rolling back some changes to military pensions, changes, I should add, that were part of this bipartisan budget deal we got last December. So not old stuff here. All along, Democrats in the White House, they were saying they weren't interested in any of these add-ons, that they wanted a clean debt ceiling increase. And that's the bill they got from the House.
This thing, as you pointed out before we actually got on the air, goes until the 15th of March in 2015, the Ides of March. And you can read into that what you will. But that's an extraordinarily long time. It's more than a year, right?
Yeah, it's a very long time, and I think that's most significant for political reasons, that, you know, in between now and then we've got these midterm elections. You know, I spent some time on the phone today, though, talking to economists, and they said that 12, 13 months would get us something that's been pretty elusive, and that's certainty. And we hear that word a lot from economists and investors and business owners. The certainty we're talking about here, Kai, is the certainty that another bruising fight over the debt limit isn't right around the corner. And that should be pretty good news for the economy.
You were at the White House today for the press conference with President Obama and François Hollande, the president of France. Did this come up at all?
I was in the East Room. The thing lasted a little more than an hour. Huh. And amazingly, President Obama didn't say debt limit or debt ceiling the entire time. And it got me thinking about how different the mood has been surrounding this than the last time we went through it. And certainly since 2011, when we came so close to the brink. And, you know, I think there are a few reasons why that is. I mean, back then, raising the debt limit was sort of wrapped up in this bigger debate over budget issues. That wasn't the case this time. And I think there's some fatigue. I mean, I think we've been through this so many times now. It's been so bruising. People are tired of it. And economists told me that today. And then, you know, I think people are confident that when all said and done, when we're sort of up against the debt ceiling, lawmakers are going to come to a deal. Obviously, the shutdown was the exception there. But, you know, I think that here things worked out.
Worth pointing out very quickly as I let you go, this passed with basically Democratic votes, right? It was 28 Republicans who said yes to this thing.
Exactly.
All right. David Gura in Washington. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Kai.
All right. Be good. Elsewhere in Washington today, Janet Yellen, as I said, made her first schlep up Capitol Hill as the head of the Federal Reserve. Chair, by the way, is how she has let it be known she would like to be referred to. No gender pronouns. Thank you very much. Anyway, it was a fairly standard set of Fed chair testimony, notable mostly for questions about how much change we ought to expect from what the guy who just left had been doing. Marketplace's Chrissy Clark is on that one.
Kai, here are the differences you'll see between Janet Yellen and her predecessor, Ben Bernanke. None. This is going to be a quick spot. Yellen told Congress economic growth is looking up, the job market could be better, the Fed is going to continue to cut back monthly bond purchases, all kind of like when Bernanke was in charge. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
When there's nothing to say, there's nothing to say. Am I right? On Wall Street today, you can credit Yellen. You can credit the debt limit deal. You can make up your own reason if you like. Whichever way you slice it, Wall Street liked it. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There was a report out today from the College Board saying the number of high school students in this country taking advanced placement exams has nearly doubled over the past 10 years. The class of 2013 collectively took more than 3 million AP tests, in fact, which at $89 a whack adds up to a whole lot of revenue for the College Board, the nonprofit that runs the AP program. Marketplace's Mark Garrison has our story on the economics of preparing for college.
If your high school experience was a while ago, you probably took nowhere near as many AP classes as modern-day students like Brooke Huang in North Carolina.
I took, let's see, this might take me a moment to remember. I took environmental science, art history, calculus AB, and world history.
And that was just her sophomore year. She's taken plenty more since. AP classes were previously a way to set yourself apart. But with college admissions increasingly competitive, many students feel they're potentially as important as the SAT, also run by the College Board. Andrea Morris, whose son is a Maryland high school student, says test fees add up fast.
If your son or daughter is taking more than one, you know, you could be spending several hundred dollars. That's real money to many families.
Morris knows other parents who set aside their tax refunds to pay test fees. It's also real money for the College Board. Revenue from the AP program is a key part of a company that brings in more than $750 million a year. Senior VP Trevor Packer hears the complaints from parents, but says testing is costly to run. He also says board research shows families see the opportunity to earn college credit as a fair deal.
We haven't seen that $89 exam fee is a barrier for most students.
And the College Board does reduce fees for low-income kids. With a college degree more important than ever and AP classes seen as the path to great schools, more parents will be shelling out for their kids to take these tests. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
All right, different topic now. Car sales in China are a whole different beast than they are here. There are registration limits on the number of cars in certain cities. There are import tariffs, and there are straight-ahead markups, too. Foreign car makers typically mark up their luxury vehicles by more than 100%. Tesla, which plans to start selling its luxury electric Model S in China next month, has a somewhat different strategy. It's offering what it calls a fair price to its Chinese customers. Our man in Shanghai, Rob Schmitz, takes Tesla's China pricing strategy out for a spin.
There's a reason the big automakers charge as much as they possibly can in China for their top-end models. China's rich are always willing to spend more, says Michael Lasky, CEO of the vehicle testing company AVL China.
From the point of view of having something that everybody knows is expensive as a means to show that you've made it, I think people are more inclined to want to spend higher prices.
But Tesla's announced the price of its Model S electric car in China will only be 50% higher than its U.S. price. The company says it still has to account for unavoidable taxes and shipping costs. Jack Burkowski, founder of JFP Holdings, thinks Tesla's pricing strategy is brilliant.
You know, it's kind of a good marketing tool. But, you know, they need that because, you know, they got some other shortcomings they have to overcome.
Like trying to sell electric vehicles in a market where environmentally conscious is largely a foreign spending habit. But forget Chinese consumers, says AVL's Michael Lasky. China's government is the one at the controls of the economy, and it wants more electric vehicles.
So I think the Chinese government strategy is to try to be a market leader in the electrification area. So any company that comes in and supports this approach, I think would be welcomed.
Tesla plans to open operations in a dozen Chinese cities and achieve a third of its overall growth from China by the end of this year, an ambitious goal for a newcomer, but one that Lasky thinks is reachable. After all, Tesla only sold around 20,000 cars last year, and China now has more than a million millionaires, many of them looking for the newest flashy sports car. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
To review, if I might, the economic news of the day. Janet Yellen told Congress the economy is getting better, that interest rates are going to stay low for a while, and that even though jobs are being added, unemployment is still way too high out there. A growing number of the jobs we're getting, about a third of them, actually, are freelance gigs. Contingent employment is what economists call that. And of course, this being the way things work, there's a whole new industry that's popped up to help all those self-employed workers. Shannon Mullen has more.
The corporate headquarters of OU Hero is just a conference room in a Boston office building. The tiny startup is about to launch a website to help freelancers find work. Members can build a virtual storefront and list their skills for prospective employers. Everything from dog walking and personal shopping to
online marketing, editing, marketing, creative direction, which I did for the site, administrative
co-founder
services,
John Evans Madden is the company's entry, chief marketing officer. He's also an OU sales, Hero client with an active profile on the site. Services.
Fundraising, nonprofit management, paralegal.
Are those all your skills?
If you got in touch with me and said, I need this done, right now I would do it. With a lot of success, this list will be pared back really rapidly to maybe one.
Evans Madden says the company wants freelancers to think of themselves as heroes for hire instead of hustling so much and sometimes getting hustled.
We think that it should be much, much, much easier to make a living in the United States with all the technology we have.
Freelancers get paid through the site minus an 8% cut for the company. Evans Madden says that's below industry standard. And for such a young industry, OU Hero has a lot of competition. Andrew Carpy is with staffing industry analysts.
We've seen an explosion in online work platforms such as Odesk and Elance.
Carpy says before the recession, there were about 24 job sites for freelancers. Now he puts the number at 80 or more.
These online platform businesses are innovating, even revolutionizing how those two sides of work, supply and demand, come together.
That matchmaking is just the start of this new relationship between freelancers and the free market. Once workers get jobs, other new companies want to sell them time management software or billing services. New York-based Harvest offers online invoicing that sends automatic reminders when employers don't pay.
So people are picking up different tools that are allowing them to be really good at the business end stuff, as well as what their core competency that they actually get paid for.
Jeremy Neuner is CEO of NextSpace, one of a growing number of companies that offer co-working sites. They're shared office spaces where freelancers can be more productive than in their living rooms and meet clients they want to impress. Neuner says more than half of NextSpace members are self-employed.
There's such a huge market to serve. So we have every intention, we're at 9 locations now, to be 10 times that size by the end of the decade.
At that point, estimates show half the American workforce could be freelancing. Steve King is a consultant at Emergent Research.
Industry is realizing that the freelancers and what we call the independent workforce has reached a scale that they want to serve it.
At least those who can afford to be served. But King says a lot of the new products are free or low cost.
We're going to see freelancing easier to do, which is good because it's traditionally been hard.
And that means more time to enjoy some of the perks of self-employment. In Boston, I'm Shannon Mullen for Marketplace.
Coming up, forget binge watching, y'all. Binge reading is where it's at.
And they want more, and they want more. And so publishers, in some sense, are kind of stoking the appetite.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials piled on 192 points today. That's 1.2%, closed at 15,994. Oh, so close. The NASDAQ gained 42 points, 1%, finished at 4,191. The S&P 500 added 19 points, 1.1%. Ended things at 1819. Cliffs Natural Resources, which operates iron mines in the U.S., Canada, and Australia, not Cliffs Bars, as you might have thought, rose 4.5% today. That was after a hedge fund said it should spin off its international assets and double its dividend. Oh, yeah, sure. Conagra Foods shriveled more than 6% today after it lowered expectations for the year. It cited problems with its private brands division. An approaching ice storm has the state of Georgia freaked out, but that means big sales of shovels, road salt, and batteries. Thus, Atlanta-based Home Depot added a 3% today. You're listening to Marketplace.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Treasury Department is scheduled to issue its monthly statement for January. The Senate Special Committee on Aging teams with the Senate Committee on Small Business and Entrepreneurship to discuss entrepreneurship among seniors. And President Abraham Lincoln was born on February 12, 1809. Got a penny? Flip it over to the reverse side where you'll see the Lincoln Memorial. That design was put in place in honor of the former president's 150th birthday. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Even now, nearly 4 years after the law was signed, there are still lots of things about Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, that are changing. Deadlines for coverage and enrollment, as we saw yesterday, and how states are dealing with the poorest and the sickest patients, people often covered by Medicaid. Today, in the latest of our series out of Camden, New Jersey, we call it Diagnosis Camden, a look at how a small healthcare team there is reinventing a Medicaid clinic. Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports from the health desk at WHYY.
The old waiting room at the Cooper University Hospital doctor's office was rough. Carpet patched with mismatched swatches and walls, Sophia Kolozowski says, that time forgot.
That a wall could be stained with marks of people's heads, and it appeared as if people were sitting there, shadows of them.
Hi, sweetie. How are you?
Kolozowski, who's worked here since 95, says you can't even imagine that now. Looking around, you see modern wood furniture, bright colors, tasteful photos of long-ago Camden on the walls.
We don't need to have that inner-city ghetto look for our patients here. We need to make them feel comfortable, that we care about them, and this speaks volumes.
When you strip away all the bells and whistles at the Cooper Advanced Care Center, Executive Director Kathy Stillo says what you see is a massive effort to make primary and specialty care as easy to get as just showing up at the ER.
I think we're figuring out how to redo this whole thing, how to deliver care in a much smarter and more efficient way.
Transforming the whole practice has taken a financial investment and a leap of faith. This office was designed exclusively for the hospital's nearly 10,000 Medicaid patients, patients who are often unemployed, homeless, mentally ill, and sick. Armed with a mandate from Cooper and $1 million from a New Jersey philanthropic group, the Nicholson Foundation, Stillo hopes to fuse patients to their healthcare providers.
Our feeling is make sure that these aren't just doctors and patients seeing each other in short clips, but there are more comprehensive teams wrapped around those patients.
Stillo, who came from Big Pharma, was brought in to look at this as a business problem to solve. Cooper lost $3 million providing care to this population last year. And under the Affordable Care Act, Medicaid's going to grow, perhaps covering up to nearly a quarter of the population, which is just one reason why hospitals around the country are looking at their Medicaid patients, some for the first time in decades.
Welcome to the group visit. My name is Dr. Kaufman.
At Cooper, the office has started these group visits with 8 to 12 patients, all with diabetes, for example, to spend an hour with a doctor and other staff to learn ways to better manage their condition. If a patient ends up in the ER or hospital, someone from here will go bedside to schedule a follow-up primary care visit within 7 days. The other thing, and it doesn't sound sexy, but is already paying off, reconfiguring basic office functions. That task often falls to Evan Gaston.
My job is to operationalize the big ideas.
When he first arrived, Gaston found a chaotic Grand Central-type scene. Phones ringing constantly. Imagine, Gaston says, patients lining up waiting to check in, others waiting to check out, workers overwhelmed.
Well, at the same time, they've got a phone balanced on their neck and saying, oh, please, can I hold one moment? And they'd put the phone down and it would ring again. And we're talking 700 calls a day.
The answer seemed kind of obvious. Move calls away from the front desk. Build some kind of call center. Sounds straightforward, right? But dealing with that kind of thing, what sometimes is called organizational spaghetti, took Gaston 2 solid months. Norma Martinez, who's worked the front desk for 11 years, says whatever it took, it was worth it. Patients, she said, often got angry, like the time a woman went off after she had to be rescheduled because her doctor was called away suddenly.
I'm not getting my medicines. I'm not being treated right. You know, I'm going to F you up. The cops came up.
And that kind of thing happened?
Let's say in a month, maybe 3 times. Yeah.
And now?
Yeah, we've only had maybe out of the whole time, 8 months, I think maybe twice.
Less frustrated patients? That's a good thing. But it's not the same as reducing ER visits and hospital admissions. Columbia Health Policy Professor Michael Sperr says what the new clinic is trying to do, getting buy-in from patients, is incredibly tough.
Now you're asking them really to change their behavior in significant ways, and they've got to trust the people who are asking them to do that, that this is going to be better for them. Talking about changing the delivery system for the high-cost, low-income population in the United States, and changing delivery systems is not easy to do.
Spare says no one's yet figured out some model that can be franchised like McDonald's, but the demand for solutions is growing. Bloomberg Industries estimates that at least $50 billion was spent last year managing Medicaid patients. In Camden, costs have come down 10% after the first several months, partly because patients like 60-year-old Nick Panero, who had a pain come out of nowhere, could get right into the clinic.
Sometimes I didn't get an appointment here for 2 weeks. That has changed. You know, it seems like they take you right in if they have to.
Kind of the way Kathy Stillo at the office drew it up, seeing patients quickly so they don't have to go to the ER. Stillo's thrilled to help people like Nick Panero every day, but she also knows the clinic is part of something bigger, tinkering with how healthcare is delivered so people are healthier and we all end up paying less money. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
I don't know about you, but I am all excited for Valentine's Day. Yes, because it's Valentine's Day, sure, fine, whatever. But also because that's when Netflix is going to release the second season of House of Cards. Can you say binge watching, anybody? But it turns out it's not just TV we want to binge on, books as well. Prompted by an article in the New York Times today describing something called series publishing, that is, publishers rolling out shorter books faster and faster and faster. We've called Harvard Business School historian Nancy Kane to talk things over. Nancy, it's good to have you back.
Always a real pleasure, Kai.
So first things first, are you a binge watcher before we get to the idea of binge reading?
I'm not, but I don't think I'm typical because binge watching, which I think really precedes binge reading, right, is on the rise, no question about it.
Yeah, and then this idea of binge reading is, it's a business model shift. It's a paradigm shift for parts of the publishing industry.
It sure is. So think about it, right? You get these well-known authors, right, to send out one piece of the story, the Hunger Games, and then you get a very eager, hungry audience, no pun intended, and they want more and they want more. And so publishers, in some sense, are kind of stoking the appetite of readers, you know, mostly doing this with established authors. And then they can very, very quickly, in a sense, generate a whole lot of book sales or often ebook sales based on the fact that, like the next episode of Downton Abbey or the next episode of The Following or Breaking Bad, we want more.
That's exactly right. But what does this say about the American consumer, this entire binge thing that has started happening?
So let's remember that the idea of, in effect, serializing a story, which is what this is, it's serializing a story. It's not that we're going to really offer, you know, a lot of brand new stuff. We're going to part it out from the publishing side. That's not new. George Eliot did it with Middlemarch. Right. Dickens did it 100 years ago with all his books. That piece isn't new. What's interesting is how much this has become part of the demand side, the consumer side of the economy, right, including how we watch television. And my take on this is threefold. One, I think this is about book sales mimicking television. And we get it in the same kind of genres, you know, that we watch in big binges, if you will. We get it in thriller genres, romantic genres, detective genres, sci-fi genres. Those are the places. It's not political economy books. It's not history books. It's not biography that we're binge reading. And there are two other pieces that I think are important at a deeper level behind the binge watching and the binge reading. One is, I think, shortening attention span. And I actually this morning got on the internet and tried to find some decent data on attention spans. Here is what I learned. The average American attention span in 2013 was about 8 seconds. This is decent data.
No, come on.
I'm dead serious. The average attention span in 2000 was 12 seconds. And then get this kicker, the average attention span of a goldfish is 9 seconds. So I think there's an aspect in which we can get into something, one thing, but we want it all right now, and then we're done with it. That's the first thing. But I think there's something else as well that's interesting. We're anxious. We get very anxious. We want to know what happens to Lady Mary on Downton Abbey. We want to
don't
know,
tell.
Right? I won't, but we want to know.
And that's not, here comes a subjective judgment. That seems to me not to be a positive thing.
See, I'm a reader and I'm a historian and yeah. I live in books. And I don't, so I'm a harumpher and a little bit of a relic. But I don't think it is a good thing. One of the great gifts of a book is that you can remember and come back to it and kind of use it in your life and in the, you know, the rooms of the house of your personality. And that's just a darn good thing.
Nancy Cain at the Harvard Business School. Nancy, thank you so much.
I always love it, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today from the Marketplace desk of pasteurized processed cheese food, Kraft says it's going to take artificial preservatives out of its American singles slices. Yes, I know it's not clear what will be left behind, but here are the mechanics. Sorbic acid is going to be replaced by something called natamycin, which we are told is a naturally occurring mold inhibitor. Which is, I suppose, good to know. The truth is, there was always something special about a grilled cheese sandwich made from Kraft Singles. Wonder? Yes, there was, is the answer to that one. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow up 192 points, 1.2%. The NASDAQ added 42 points. That's about 1%. The S&P 500 gained 19 points. That is 1.1%. Nancy Fargali and John Ketchum are the producers on our Marketplace desks. Ariana Tobin and Raghu Manavalan are our digital producers. You know my name. We'll see you tomorrow. I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.